Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
Rio is almost like an old Brazilian boyfriend. You know he's probably not quite right for you, but when you see him, you're guaranteed to have a brilliant time.
As I write, the blossoms are out, the spring sun is shining, and Tokyo is looking at its absolute best.
New York is a flawed but great city, a place you sometimes long to leave, but always miss when you're not there.
Love letters. Have you ever written one? Well, while staying put, we asked our team across the globe to reflect on what they cherish about their cities and sit down and pen a love letter. So join me across the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Welcome to this week's episode. One of the most curious things about the state of lockdown being felt across the globe is how it's made many of us find a renewed appreciation for our cities. It's a sense of nostalgia for city life as we knew it, while at the same time wondering what sort of urban living will emerge when all of this is over. So, while staying put, we asked our bureau chiefs, editors and correspondents to reflect on what they most value about their respective cities and how it's changed during the pandemic. And let's start with me right here in London. The spring sun should be a moment of promise, a hint of things to come. The blossom on the trees would normally be a sign of renewal coming around the seasonal corner, but not this year. London's energy is dimmed. There is melancholy on the breeze. People ask each other, how can this be happening? How can the small things that bind them to this complicated city have vanished so quickly? You live in a city to be among crowds, to be surprised and entertained, to fall in love and to make your name. But all of this and more is on hold. In museums, Rothko's and Turner's hang on gallery walls with nobody there to stare or glare. Restaurants, normally rammed, stand empty, chairs piled on their tables. DJ booths maintain a monastic silence. Nobody will be meeting the love of their lives in this bar tonight. London has been burnt, bombed and bruised many times in its history, and every time it's bounced back, taken the rubble of adversity and made it into something better and brighter. This time, it's not a war to fear, but a virus. Yet the social distancing required to quell its progress eats at the city and its very meaning. And it's hard to live with the fact that nobody knows when the demand to stand far away from friends, neighbours and colleagues will lift. But when this is all over, then, I want to wait in a busy restaurant queue. I want to sit in the dark in a packed theatre, squeeze into a tube carriage filled with late-night revellers, hang out all day in a cafe, walk among Londoners, embrace my friends. London has been the backdrop to my life. Its streets hold my stories and my hopes, just like many others. Oh, London, I hate what you're going through, but please don't let this beat you. We need you back very soon. Now to Hong Kong. The city has just extended its social distancing restrictions, which this time will include the closure of some bars and pubs, gyms, cinemas, mahjong parlours, nightclubs, beauty salons, and massage parlours. A return to normality is still a distant future, but that's something our bureau chief in the city, James Chambers, has got used to by now. Here, he tells us how covering the pro-democracy protests made him realise his allegiance to the city.
Hong Kong and I became official last June, a good 8 months before the coronavirus came along to test us. Our status changed from casual to committed during the pro-democracy protests. That's when I went all in, finally acknowledging, after 5 years, that Hong Kong is my home, and not a temporary stopover before I head back to London. I remember the exact moment it happened. I'd just been reporting on Monocle 24, Our presenter, Marcus Hippie, had been talking to me live from the broadcasting studio Midori House while I was watching ordinary citizens being tear-gassed by riot police and seeking shelter in a high-end shopping mall. When I got back to my apartment that evening, I left the lights off and just stared out of the window. Tears came to my eyes for the first time in over a decade. Okay, they weren't actual tears, but I almost cried. You can take the boy out of Britain, but his stiff upper lip remains. But what I'd just seen on the streets that night forced me to acknowledge how much I cared about what happens to this city, to my city. Standing alone in the dark, I realized that I was no longer a spectator. The coronavirus has changed everything, except how I feel about my city. There have been no jitters, no second thoughts, no question of leaving town and heading back to London, where I now feel like a tourist. Hong Kong is where I head back to these days, and it's the only city where I get that warm and fuzzy homecoming feeling. I'm usually coming back from a reporting trip somewhere around Asia. Somehow it's always nighttime, and I'm sitting on the back seat of a red taxi, driving into the city from the airport. As soon as I see the busy dockyard, I sit up and gaze out of the window. There's a real romance to the red lights on the cranes, and the stacks and stacks and stacks of shipping containers. Right now, I'm writing this aboard a plane, as I fly back from Indonesia to Hong Kong, where I'll have to begin 2 weeks of mandatory home quarantine. It'll be dark when I get back, and I fully intend to appreciate the vista during my taxi ride, knowing that I might not get to see it for at least another few months. To say that I'm looking forward to leaving Hong Kong again might sound like an odd way to end a love letter to my city, but it's the only way I'll get to feel the pleasure of coming back home.
That was Monocle's James Chambers in Hong Kong, and thank you to him. Now we're off to Rio de Janeiro, where despite Brazil's president's continuous denial of coronavirus and the dangers associated with it, cariocas are taking precautions and changing the city as they go along. Here's Monocle's Latin America affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott.
Rio is almost like an old Brazilian boyfriend. You know he's probably not quite right for you, but when you see him, you're guaranteed to have a brilliant time. The city that overlooks the Atlantic is wild and proud and jaw-droppingly beautiful. But then it's also a bit of a mess and terribly unreliable. I took a chance on Rio becoming my boyfriend again at the start of the year, moving from the more serious and orderly business hub of São Paulo. Carnival and long summer nights were about to begin. We spent days walking the city streets, living by the seafront and dancing like children to samba beats, and all to the backdrop of beaches and colonial mansions. We also had a major water crisis in January, people frantically buying bottled Perrier because the stuff out the tap smelt like rotten fruit, just in case I'd started to think I was falling for the city again. As part of their routine, Rio locals or cariocas began stockpiling water, a peculiar sign of things to come. News of the virus didn't reach Rio until February 26, the afternoon the week-long carnival celebrations came to an end. It was almost too well timed. Suddenly we were shutting ourselves away. No more parties, no glitter, no curbside drinks, no more bar hopping, sunbathing, or endless parades. No fun. But as cities across Brazil and beyond have been forced into a semi-lockdown state, some would argue that staying with the unreliable boyfriend is ill-advised. But it's here where I've been proved wrong. Suddenly, Rio's small monkeys that pop up onto the balcony to say a friendly hello. His streets, now empty, but lined with endless green palms. His soothing samba playing from neighbours' windows, and the sounds of his familiar waves pushing in from the Atlantic are exactly what gets you through a crisis. Who would have thought newfound love could be brought on by a pandemic?
Well, a report there from Lucinda Elliott in Rio de Janeiro. Toronto is known for being chilly, and not just in the winter. But our bureau chief, Thomas Lewis, tells us how the city warms up in times of trial and triumph. Let's have a listen.
On the 17th of June last year, a Monday, Toronto was gearing up for a big day. Its biggest day in the eyes of many. The Toronto Raptors basketball team had triumphed in the NBA conference, beating the odds to become the first non-American team ever to win the sport's biggest professional prize. And the team was coming home for its victory parade that day. The city had been glued to every dribble of its team's triumphant march to the top. In homes, in an official fan zone known as Jurassic Park, in bars, cafes and even bookshops that had set up screening nights for Raptors games. Many restaurants bore gold and white stickers in their windows with the words Kawine and Dine, a promise and a plea to the team's then star, the American player Kawhi Leonard, that he could eat for free if he promised to stay in Toronto at season's end. My colleague at Monocle's Toronto Bureau, Will Kitchens, is a basketball fan. I am not. But I'll happily hop on a bandwagon with no shame and little apology as it rolls into town. So off we set in the blazing June sun to take our spots along the parade route. We were just two faces in a crowd of 2 million people. Toronto's greater population is about 6 million, who had snuck out of work or school to witness their hero's return. It's a team that, unlike the city's other big-ticket sports franchises, actually looks like the city itself in terms of race, heritage and economic class. Toronto is the only big city in the world where more than half of us who live here, 52% according to the last census, were born somewhere else. I'm sure I'm not the only person in Toronto who misses that day. Toronto, for me, is sometimes hamstrung by an aloofness, an uncertainty perhaps about who it is as a city. It's a place where you fend for yourself, where there is sometimes a polite distance between you and your neighbour. But not on parade day last year, and not now. In the 5 years or so that I've called the city home, I've found that it's in a collective moment that Toronto's at its best. We aren't standing shoulder to shoulder with strangers in the streets right now as we were on that Monday in June. But we are, as the signs say, which have replaced the gold and white stickers of a year ago in the windows of the shops, cafes and bookstores that are closed for now, all in this together.
Thank you to Thomas. That's Thomas Lewis, who's our man in Toronto, and this is The Urbanist. Next, Milan. Italy remains at the forefront of this pandemic here in Europe, and this city, along with the entire Lombardy region, has now been under lockdown for over a month. Our correspondent in Milan, Ivan Cavallo, tells us how a long, forced quarantine has changed his perspective on the urban environment around him. Here he is.
Now into our second month of quarantine, Milan's streets remain silent, save for the sound of ambulance sirens and delivery trucks. The latter is a reminder that while shops are shuttered, goods can be procured online. During lockdown, one positive has been the arrival to my doorstep of wines from small-scale producers from Italy's northern regions. A walk among the vines now takes place in my mind as I sniff and sip Italy's many indigenous varietals. While my neighborhood butcher, the meat maestro Mauro Brun, at Macelleria L'Annunciata, still prepares his superb cuts for drop-in shoppers, the restaurants he serves are still on pause. Ever since Milan's World's Fair in 2015, the city's dining scene has been a whirlwind of activity, with new concepts and emerging chefs dreaming up menus both fanciful and straightforward. Many here dearly miss their local trattoria and the informal chats with a favorite waiter or sommelier. The same can be said for the local cafe, that for me, as for many Italians, is a daily fixture. The chance to peruse the local papers at the counter as I sip espresso, or nibble on homemade pizzas during the aperitivo hour are simple pleasures now out of reach. These convivial moments are what make my city tick. The cafe, so central to Italian life, brings together members of my local community. They are from all walks of life, a furniture restorer, an architect, a lawyer, a photographer. Over a glass of red wine or a Negroni cocktail, opinions are shared, news is exchanged, and jokes are told. These are the bonds that build a neighborhood. Though my world has become insular, there are still things to discover. I, like many city dwellers in Milan, have made connections with neighbors as we sit out on our balconies, taking in the sunshine. One inquires about our family's new kitten as my children play downstairs in the courtyard, a transitory space that is now converted into a makeshift playground where sword fights and push scooter races take place. This patch of pavement makes me appreciate how lucky I am to have nearby two large parks and a sports complex where children after school can run with wild abandon without a care in the world. Children playing on swings and slides, pensioners chatting on a park bench, waiters telling regulars about the latest specials, or a barista pulling a shot of espresso. All these make up the soundtrack of city life in Milan. They are music to my ears and sounds I hope to hear again very soon.
Many thanks to Ivan in Milan. Let's move east to Greece, where our Venetia Rainey brings us a love letter to Athens.
As Europe started to shut down, I made a decision. It was time to flee London and go home to Athens. Although most cities outside of Italy were not yet in lockdown, I knew things were getting serious when I heard the government had closed the Acropolis. I arrived back on a Saturday night, and my normally heaving metro from the airport into town was almost completely empty. Since then, like the 3 million or so other Athenians cooped up at home, I've had to enjoy the city from my balcony and revel in memories of things I used to do in my 2 years of living here. So, every morning, I drink in the view of tree-covered Lycabettus, the tallest hill in Athens, and I fantasize about having a beer or three outside St. George's Chapel at the top. It's the perfect place to watch Greece's vivid sunset wash over the historic Parthenon and the Mediterranean Sea. Or sometimes I turn my head to the left and gaze at Hymettus, one of several impressive mountain ranges bordering Athens. Tipped with snow in winter, right now it's never looked greener and more inviting. When all this is over, I promise to myself, the first thing I will do is jump on a bus and hike up to its rocky crest, where on a clear day you can see the islands of Aegina, Andros and Evia, and the din of the city fades away beneath you. Of course, the city's din has already largely faded away. The worry about what a reduction in tourism will do to this country's barely recovered economy is very real, and with Orthodox Easter fast approaching, there's a sadness in the air that residents won't be able to gather to celebrate the biggest holiday of the year as usual. But Athens is not short on reminders that the country has been through worse before. From temples that have withstood wars and the fall of entire civilizations, to graffiti on the walls from the dark days of austerity, Greece's capital is a battle-hardened survivor. The city may be in hibernation mode, but whenever it does awake from its slumber, I know it won't be long until the squares are once again filled with families, friends, and lovers coming together to make the most of those long, balmy Mediterranean nights. On second thoughts, I think when all this is over, the first thing I'll do is join them.
That's Monocle's Venetia Rainey, who's based in Athens and is also our business editor. And this is The Urbanist. For our next check-in, we cross the Atlantic. Monocle's America's large editor, Ed Stocker, tells us how he'd like to wake up the city that never sleeps from its current dormant state. Here he is.
New York is known as the city that never sleeps, except that's not quite true at the moment. The city might not be out cold, but it's in a deeply dormant state. Manhattan is deserted as the cultural offerings that make the city so lively have shut down. New York has always had narcotic properties for some, and it has never been a case of sitting on the fence. You're either a lover or a hater. What gets you is the buzz of business, the sense that something extraordinary or unusual could happen to you, even as the city has become more elite, and the notion that great success, whether social or financial, is just around the corner. To see that stifled in recent weeks is hard, but it's also completely clear to me that this city will bounce back. And while the current situation is unprecedented, the Big Apple has weathered blizzards before, from September the 11th to Hurricane Sandy. So what do I want to see return? Normalcy, of course. From a personal viewpoint, I want to be cycling into Manhattan, seeing a film at Nighthawk Cinema, and going to the Studio 54 exhibition at Brooklyn Museum that was due to open in March. But more than that, I want to see the city imperfectly humming as before. I want to see the curry houses of Jackson Heights full again, the Russians and Ukrainians of Brighton Beach strutting their stuff on the boardwalk as the weather warms, and the West Village bars and restaurants heaving. I think I may even want to see the tourists come back. When everything does return to normal, I'm certain there will be one hell of a party. Why do I care? Because New York is a flawed but great city. A place you sometimes long to leave, but always miss when you're not there. And it has somehow managed to capture my heart.
Monocle's America's Editor-at-Large, Ed Stocker there. Finally, on today's programme, to Tokyo. Monocle's Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson tells us how Japan's capital has revealed resilience and grace when tested by circumstances. Here she is.
Tokyo and I have shared the best times over the years. Exhilarating late nights, outrageously good meals, many, many laughs, and 1,000 small acts of kindness. We've had some dark days too. I'm thinking of the grim period after the triple earthquake tsunami nuclear meltdown of 2011, when Tokyo dimmed, both literally and metaphorically, as the lights were turned down in a collective bid to save electricity. I remember wondering then if the city would ever regain its joie de vivre. I was reminded of those stressful times when we got the sudden, shocking news on a Thursday in late February that all schools were to close from the following week. It was a sobering wake-up call. This was no longer a distant crisis. Weeks on, the closure of schools has become the new normal. Tokyo has not experienced the full lockdown that other cities have endured. Restaurants and shops have mostly stayed open, even if they have shorter hours and fewer patrons. Masks are standard attire, and hand sanitizer ubiquitous. The limitations on public behavior have been expressed in the most Japanese way. Schools were requested to close. People asked to refrain from their usual cherry blossom picnics. More direct orders have been deemed unnecessary. Working for the good of the group is both a Japanese trope and a reality of life here. The custom of bowing comes into its own in these contact-free times, and masks were already a common sight, as people routinely wear them to avoid passing colds on to others. There's a wistful feeling with the Tokyo 2020 flag still fluttering, even though the Olympics have been postponed. The city was ready to host the world, with finishing touches completed to the National Stadium, new hotels opening, and volunteers being trained in their thousands. As I write, the blossoms are out, the spring sun is shining, and Tokyo is looking at its absolute best. The experience of 2011 taught me a few things about the resilience and thoughtfulness of Tokyo's citizens, their stoicism and lack of self-pity. The city did indeed recover its energy, a unique mix of civility and possibility. I think back to a conversation I had a few years ago with a centenarian owner of a Tokyo coffee shop, who could still recall with clarity the earthquake in 1923 that reduced swathes of the capital and his family home to rubble. The city bounced back from that catastrophe only to be incinerated in 1945. It recovered from that too. Tokyo is a city with longevity on its side, and it will come through these challenges just as it has before.
Well, that was Monocle's Fiona Wilson in Tokyo, who's been bringing to life the story of that city across Monocle 24's airwaves in recent days. Well, I hope you'll agree that's an amazing list of love letters, an amazing cache of love letters from our great editors and our correspondents around the world. Cities are quiet at the moment, and as you wander around the city and you see those store windows frozen in time, restaurants with their tables piled high with chairs, places just waiting for return, it's a strange moment for all of us to think about our cities in this incredible kind of lockdown. And despite all those we'll be back signs and wait for us, we'll be back in the coming weeks notices, we don't know yet what will be back and what this city or any of our cities will feel like when we emerge on the other side of the pandemic. I think all of us harbour hopes and dreams that many of the things that we loved before all this began will be there and will rekindle and will flourish again. But we just don't know. And also, we don't know whether some of the positives that have come out of this time, the strength of community, a growing awareness of each other's needs, a touch of niceness that was perhaps absent before, whether that will manage to stay with us, whether that will actually weaken within days or weeks as people get back to their bustling lives. But what's clear is that for all of us, you know, the cities we live in, this sense which I talked about at the beginning of the program, that they are places that hold our histories. You know, you walk around and you see a cafe that you went to once for a date. There's a cinema where you remember a magical moment. There are parks that have been parts of your routines. There are places that you took your parents to or that, you know, you had terrible times in, but somehow when you walk around, they all hold a little bit of your history. That's what makes cities hard to leave in the end. Your life is reflected in their windows and in their buildings and in the brickwork almost. That it's just very difficult to see them all as they are. But as we said, it has brought out a kind of a passion for our cities, which is really important to value. So we'll see what happens over the coming weeks. The Urbanist has had a real sense of purpose, I think, over recent episodes. And I thought today's show was a great testament to the value of urbanism, the value of cities made well. And as usual, at this point in the show, I'd just like to say I hope you're all well and safe, and that as you look out of your windows, you see a city that you still love and that you wish to engage with again as soon as this lockdown is lifted. But that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlos Rabello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. To play you out of this week's episode, here's Metronomy with Love Letters. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.